Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to Circumstance. I'm your host, Gina Cafasso. In this episode, we spotlight my guest, Aaron Smith, a creative force in the animation industry whose journey is as compelling as the characters he brings to life. Known for his exceptional talent in animation, he carved out a niche for himself, contributing to the magic behind the scenes of many of our favorite animated features. His expertise in visual effects and character animation has left an indelible mark on the industry, showcasing his ability to breathe life into stories through his artistry. However, Aaron's narrative is not just about his achievements in animation. It's also a tale of legacy and inspiration, deeply rooted in the art and literary contributions of his father, Robert Graysmith. Robert, a renowned author and artist, is best known for his investigative work on the Zodiac Killer case, which captivated readers and transitioned to the silver screen, profoundly influencing the thriller genre. Together, they represent a lineage of creativity and passion for storytelling that spans different mediums but shares a common thread, captivating audiences with their work. Aaron's animation and Robert's gripping true crime tales remind us of the power of narrative and its ability to transcend boundaries. So sit back, relax, and join us as we explore the dynamic world of Aaron Smith, where every frame is a brushstroke on the canvas of imagination, and the legacy of Robert Graysmith, where every word penned is a clue in the puzzle of human intrigue. This is a journey through the interplay of light and shadow, fact and fiction, art and legacy. Welcome to the story behind the stories. Okay, so let's talk about you now. So your father obviously was, cartoonist. I call artist. Wouldn't you say artist? So you're an amazing artist, animator, and now publisher, and writer, and film producer, animator. You do it all. So tell me, how did he influence that? Or did he influence that?
Oh, well, no, he definitely had influence in there. You know, I think it was always seeing him draw. I can't remember if I talked about this last time, but just he was sort of like, no, he was always very supportive and everything, and would talk. And I don't remember sitting down with him and drawing so much. I do remember drawing some dinosaurs at one point for something, some like science fair or something. I did this T-Rex that was pretty good. And he came over and he's like, what if you do like this? And he drew this little sneer in the corner. And I remember that being kind of like, wow, you know, added some character to this dinosaur. But no, he's always very supportive in that way. But same with my mom too. I think they were always very supportive. And interested to see like what you're doing creatively. And, you know, I think I was a big self-starter with stuff too, though. So it kind of, it's a little bit like just set it and forget it to a degree.
So you've worked in the entertainment industry for a very long time. How many years and doing what?
So I've jumped around a bit. I think, you know, my first real job I got was working Tower Records. And I was in high school and I was dating this girl. And at the time we would, every weekend we'd go see a movie. Back to my movie MO. Mm-hmm. That's Friday, let's go see a movie. We'd want to go do stuff and eat out and whatever. And at some point we both realized like, we haven't got any money. You know, neither of us had any money. And so that it was just right around summer was starting and she was going to Berkeley High. I was going to a different school. And she said, hey, they have this job board over here. So we went and we visited the job board, which was in this trailer that was parked on the campus. It was just all these little index cards pinned to a wall. And I saw one that said like graphic designer. I don't even know if it said that it was Tower Records, but oh, that sounds interesting. And I called the guy and I won't say his name, but he says, oh, come on over, you know? And I went over and they were remodeling the store at the time. So it sort of closed for business, but I went in the back and went up the stairwell. That what had been the attic, they turned into the art department. And at some point they didn't even know they had the space. And it had just been this like a trap door in the ceiling kind of attic. And then, so I don't know if it was around that time or at some point in the history of the store, they had put in a stairway that went up to it. So, and then there was a little bathroom in there. We could wash our brushes out and stuff. I came up and there were a bunch of guys in this room and everybody's working away on painting stuff and doing things. And he starts explaining to me what foam core is. I'd never seen it before. And basically he was looking for someone to make section signs. And they were the central art department for the chain. There were art departments local at each store, but for that one, they would actually, anytime a new store opened up, we'd make all the section signs and package them up and then mail them. And then he would go out there and like set up the store. And we'd do displays as well just to get them started. But the section signs are a big deal. You might do like 100 section signs that say like rock, pop, soul, Western, country, you know. And so I got in that job. And I think that was the first time I really got like paid to do something creative. That was really, it was neat. You know, I'd go over there. I was still in high school at the time. I'd come over and just work a little half week there part-time. And then in the summers, I'd let it fill my whole day. They'd let it. So I worked there. Eventually, when I got into UCLA, I came down here and I was supposed to have a job lined up. And I got there and the guy's like, oh yeah, I didn't fire my artist. And
oh,
so
right.
I'm like, oh, I was supposed to be the new artist at the classical store in Sunset. He goes, yeah, I never had that conversation with him. But you know, across the street, they got a new manager, a new regional manager, and I think he wants to do some. So I just walked over there and it was my first afternoon in Los Angeles. And I walk across the street. I say, can I talk to the manager? And I go in there. I say, hey, I worked out at the Berkeley store. He goes, Berkeley? Did you work for Steve Pilutro? I said, yeah. He goes, you're hired. That was the whole thing. I basically said I worked at the sign shop. You know, we didn't call it that, but
now was it a Tower Records or what? It was a different.
This company? Was the flagship. It was Tower Records on Sunset. You know, the big store. And so that was kind of funny. Like, oh, I came to town and I mentioned someone's name and it just happened.
Boom! Wow.
But I did. You know, I was doing really good work and stuff. And I did. I don't know if I had him with me, but I had photos and stuff of all the stuff I did. But he's like, start Monday. This was on a Friday. So I came to town, I found an apartment, got a job in the same day, and, you know,
rest is history.
Westwood for, I sublet a place in Westwood for 2 months during the summer. But so anyhow, so that was kind of the way I got down here. And then through college, I worked at Tower. I had, you know, college was still kind of affordable then. I want to say I was paying like $450 a quarter or something. Maybe it was more.
At UCLA? Was this at UCLA? Because we were
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a
but
lot.
I know by the time I left, it was $1,500 a quarter. It had yeah. like... Really, it was the start of where everything started ballooning.
Right.
So I sort of got in and out like just in time, I think. But I was able to, you know, I worked and I was able to cover most of my bills and, you know, five of us in an apartment kind of situation. And actually my first summer here when I was on Sunset, there's another guy that worked there, one of the other artists. We were in the basement of the video store and it was so different from Berkeley because it was just this tiny room with one giant desk and three of us around it.
Oh, wow.
And, but this guy, Alan Forbes, who did, if you ever saw like the Black Crowes or that, he did all their artwork for them, or he did around that time and later.
Yeah.
Remember that first summer, it was very lean times. And there was a point where we were both between paychecks, like, man, I don't, what are we going to do for lunch? And I know we had one period where we wanted to see, like, let's see if we can go a whole week without buying lunch or dinner or anything. And we would get like a record rep to like, oh, I think you should come down. We have some spots opening up as far as the billboards and things, you know. They come down and they take us to lunch or something. And, oh, there's a Rolling Stones release party. And we go to that. Like, okay, that's Tuesday night. Here's this.
Oh, wow.
I think it was the following week from that. We were just, you know, we didn't have much money and the checks hadn't come yet. and we had wandered down the street to the AM/PM mini market and went, 29 cent hamburger, 39 cent chicken. And we decided to eat there for the week. And so I think Alan made it till Wednesday and then called in sick. And then I think I called in sick on Thursday. I'm not saying it was
moral of the story.
Yeah. But I thought that was funny. Neither of us were feeling very good. It's like we had that whole supersize me thing going long before the documentary.
Wow. Well, starving artist, there you go. I mean, that's pretty much that.
But that was another, I loved working for Tower. You know, I mean, they weren't paying well, but.
But so how do you feel about all the Tower Records when they closed? I mean,
it's so sad.
You know, and all like the video stores, everything's just gone now. It's just so different. The world is so different.
Yeah, it's really sad. I got really excited a few weeks ago. I think they're filming a Michael Jackson biopic or something. Or I didn't know that's what it was at the time. But on Magnolia, there was some store there they had taken. They had painted it up to look like the Sunset store, but it was obviously much smaller. But it had the yellow I-beams that came out at an angle and all of that stuff. And the Tony Joni paintings on the outside of the building. And it was like, oh, I want to run over there. And then I spaced and completely forgot I was going to go take a picture while it was up.
It's already gone. Did they tear it down already? Yeah.
I think so. Somebody I knew had gone by and he's really nosy. So he had gotten I guess there's something they have to publish with the city that actually says, we'll be doing this. There'll be some driving sequences. There'll be this. There'll be that. Da, 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 da. And they have to say when they set up and when they tear down. And it was, so I knew I had missed the tear down dates.
Oh, darn. Oh, what's your favorite project you've worked on though?
Aside from Tower Records?
Yes.
I think there's a bunch. And I guess aside from my own personal stuff that I've done, I worked on Ren and Stimpy right out of college. I did a short film. And actually one of the guys I worked with at Tower Records, Scott Wills, we were in the same art department together. And during that time is when he got the job on Ren and Stimpy. And so later, after I'd done this, probably like a year later, I think, I did a short with a friend of mine and that helped get my foot in the door. So I definitely, you know, again, like name dropping, Scott introduced me to the guy and I said, oh, hey, I did this film. And, you know, so I think I was working as a PA, but then I was also part of my time. I was doing lettering and cleaning things up and prepping things to be painted and it was still semi artistic, but still kind of like, are you in the production side or in the art side, the creative side? So, but that was fun. And then as far as getting into features, around the time Ren and Stimpy ended was Space Jam was, no, sorry, there was a gap in between there, but eventually Space Jam was hiring up and just like a vacuum, just everybody in Los Angeles and people from around the world got sucked into that thing. Wow. And it's a terrible movie, but like, I met some of my best friends working on that, you know, and I worked some of my longest weeks of, you know, I think over 100 hours in many weeks. I think later I worked at Sony when I was doing live action visual effects. And I think that's the only other time I had a week that compared to that, you know, the end crunch. But most of Space Jam was overtime. It was crazy.
How many people do you think worked on that thing? You said it sucked up a lot of people, but how many? Like, do you think
tell you.
Really?
I have no idea. But what was cool is, where we were working was at Sherman Oaks Galleria, which is what's that movie? Fast Times at Ridgemont High. That's the mall.
Valley Girl. Was it Valley Girl too? Like anyway, go
probably.
Ahead. Yeah, yeah.
I always knew it for the Fast Times at Ridgemont High though. But we were working out of the Imperial Bank building that's kind of rose up out of it. And I think now it's like Comerica or something. But we're like, I think the fifth and sixth, something like that. And we were working so much at one point that like, oh, I don't have time to do laundry. Well, there's a Macy's down there. And I just go down and buy like socks and underwear and t-shirts. It was easier than trying to do laundry. But it was kind of cool because we didn't have them often, but when we had film dailies, we didn't have anywhere to look at film. We'd go down into the mall, into the movie theater there, the one that's in Fast Times. And we would sit in the theater and watch dailies projected there. So it was like, oh, that's kind of neat.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So anyhow, I wouldn't say that's my favorite one, but I definitely was impressionable and I walked away with a lot of really good friends from it, you know. And then I moved over into live action visual effects from that over at Sony Imageworks and worked on like Contact. And I did a little bit on Starship Troopers and the two Stuart Little movies. And the Stuart Little movies were great because I was working as a compositor and the first movie started and they.
And what does a compositor do? Just so. People that
Bowser's kind of the last one to touch everything to really anything technical other than eventually it goes to film, color grading and film. And, you know, oh, this is going to be for the VHS. This is going to be for the DVD. I think we had DVDs at that point. But going to film was a big, big deal, because if the data wasn't captured in the right way or the right depth, it was never going to look good on film. So, but basically we're the last, you take all the elements, you put them together, and compositing is sort of typically a 2D process. Now there's things that you'll call 3D, but that's, it's still 2D. It just treats, works with data that works in 3D. But like, for instance, somebody may animate the character, but that doesn't really look like anything. It just looks like a gray shaded thing. And then there's a point where someone else has gone through and they've textured it. And so it has skin and fur, and there's clothing that looks like cotton, and, you know, and that gets lit and rendered. And that lighting and rendering process is just creating that element. It's not actually building the whole scene. The compositing will take all of those elements. Maybe there's an explosion and there's a live action cat and there's a blue screen and there's whatever. You pull all that stuff together and put it together and you make it look seamless.
Wow.
So the start of Stuart Little, though, that we just got our first shots, and then the studio, I guess they had seen a cut of the movie or they had, something happened, and they went, whoa. We got some notes, and the whole thing just stopped. But they didn't lay anybody off during this time. They just, and we weren't sure how long it would be. So a lot of the compositors think, I wouldn't mind learning lighting, and the lighters were, wanted to learn compositing, and we cross-trained each other during that time. And I think we were able to do about three times as much work because of that in the end. It really, it was crazy how much stuff that we did. And it was really nice being able to, like, as a compositor, you're, there's this communication breakdown that happens where someone's going to hand you an element, and you don't, they're not doing what you're thinking. And you're like, oh, if I just had this mat, or if you could light me something that has a gradient on it, or if you could do this. Well, is that when you're lighting and compositing, you know when something's difficult in one tool or easy in the other, or vice versa. And you could, like, I'm going to take the time now to make this because it's very difficult to do later. Or, oh, if I have a mat for this, it's very easy to do over there. So that was really nice. But in the Stuart Little stuff, that's one that really stood out to me. I don't know if those are my favorite movies necessarily. They're not bad, but I really had a great time working on those. And that was probably one of my better working experiences. The guy that was the visual effects supervisor on that, I remember sitting in dailies one day. Every morning we'd get onto dailies for like an hour and a half, look at stuff on videotape, we'd look at stuff on film. And I'd always listen to everybody else's comments, the comments he'd given me, add a little highlights or the fur looks dirty or whatever. So I'd go back to my desk and I'd address all those notes as if he'd given them to me. That show stuff. And I remember this one day he's sitting and my shot pops up and he goes, he's holding his laser pointer and he turns back, looks over his shoulder. He sees me sitting there. He's like, is this your shot? I said, yeah. And you know what to do.
Oh,
then he goes,
nice.
Next. And it was such a, oh, it was such a great feeling. And that's always stuck with me. And then, you know, when I have people on my team, I try to do those kind of things. Like, where's the place where I can, like, you're doing it right. You know, it's, he's not the kind of guy to usually say stuff like that. He's very quick to, like, you know, make these
critique, criticize. Or
well, it might be just grunts and moans, you know.
Oh God.
So, but he was
see all of you on pins and needles, just waiting for his response, and that must have felt so good. Like, he's like, okay, moving on.
Yeah, so that was kind of, you know. And years later, when I was at DreamWorks, I sort of had, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg wouldn't see our stuff that often, but when he did, it was always this very tense. He'd see stuff and he'd, you know, hum and moan and like, and then he'd get to my sequence and he'd like, yep, good, next. And that would be it. Nice. And I'd have to take my team would look like, we did a great job. Like, did he tell, you know, take them. I'm like, no, that's fireworks. That's from him.
Great.
That's fireworks.
That's what you want.
You know, the sequence before and the sequence after, he tore them apart. You know, it's,
this is what you want, people.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Well, yeah. I remember working there. Jeffrey remembered, I don't know if you've had this experience, remembered everybody's name. You'd be walking down the hallway and I met him one time. He's like, "Hi, Gina, how you doing today?"
Yeah.
Like, wow.
I don't know how good that is or not. I know there was I don't know what the event was. One of the guys I'd worked with, and he'd been at DreamWorks before me. And there was some point where Jeffrey was calling around congratulating people or something. And so maybe there's an award, maybe when Shrek did really well, or I don't know. Yeah. So he got this call from Jeffrey, and he's like, "Wow." You know, Jeffrey calls, he gets the secretary or somebody calls up and says, "Jeffrey Katzenberg will be on the line in 1 second, or whatever, or 30 seconds, or whatever." And, "Oh, yes." And they make sure you're the person. And so she called, and he answered, and he says, "Well, hey," I won't say the guy's name, but he says, "You know, hey, I just want to thank you, and you did this and that." And Jeffrey has clearly just said his name. Mm-hmm. And thanks to me, he says a little bit of stuff, and then like, "All right, we'll say, oh, geez, thanks. Yeah, that's really great to hear from you. It's very, you know," it just struck it how personal this is. Hangs up the phone. Two minutes later, the phone rings. Jeffrey Katzenberg on the line, and he the same word for word, the same spiel. So it's like,
alrighty. You know, I do think that blows my hypothesis right out of the water.
Yeah, but he called you by name, and
it's true. We were also in the small little Lancashire office at the time. I mean, it was like this tiny little office. There wasn't many of us there because I think, I was there pretty early on. Like I was, you know, I don't even know, maybe like the 100th employee, something like that. So it was tiny at that time.
Yeah.
But he did remember us. But we were also on the music team, so it was a little different. Like we weren't, you know, on these big productions. We were a small team that worked on everything. So I think that's probably why.
Yeah, that probably. I think by the time I got there, I think they were, you know, 800 or 1500 people or something.
Yeah, because I was shocked that it was just so like, "Hey, how you doing?" Like I was like, "Wait a minute, what?" And then I remember hearing about his he went through assistance like water. I remember that because he would like get up at the crack of dawn, like 4 a.m. and start working out, and then messaging all his team. Like
he only slept 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was up super early, messaging everybody, getting everyone going, making phone calls already. And his team was like, "Can't live this way anymore." It was a lot.
Yeah.
But that's why he is who he is. I mean, you know, he's one of those guys.
Yeah. I feel like there were things that he did really well. They're not springing to mind right now, but I know I've defended him to some point in the past. But, you know, and then there's a lot of stuff you're like, "Are you kidding me?" And I do think like once, this is very not serial killer. Well, I feel like I'm so far off topic. But he, I think once that company went public and him being the CEO, it had to just be this different, this thing. And especially, you know, I think maybe after 2009, maybe that was a big part of it. Mm-hmm. When, you know, I know he was one of the guys that got ripped off by Bernie Madoff and then the whole economy just
tanked.
But there's some point in there, he started hanging out with other CEOs of other companies and seemed to be heavily influenced by them.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, suddenly we got to make an app, you know, and it's not like they were going to make their own social media app, you know. We're going to do something that does this, we're going to do that. Or, you know, eventually after he left DreamWorks, he wanted to do that Quibi thing. And that was a concept he had talked about at DreamWorks, trying to make these little like really super short form entertainments. And I don't know what the stuff with the Quibi stuff is. I don't know where any of that entertainment went.
Well, I kind of felt too, one of his main drivers at DreamWorks was to compete with Disney. I felt like I remember working on Ants and Bug's Life was coming out and we had to make sure we sped up so we got in front of Bug's Life. The other thing was like Deep Impact and Armageddon. We had to get Deep Impact out before
Armageddon. I think there was a third movie around that time too, another asteroid movie.
But they, and then all of us were like on warrant, like, okay, now we got to rush everything. I mean, everything was like sped up. So we have to beat them to market. Like that was the biggest thing. So yeah, pretty crazy stuff. Now let's take a couple steps back here. So I want to kind of go back to kind of the legacy of your dad a little bit. Like if you were to, let's say, how would you define the legacy of your dad? Like in one sentence, like what would you think that would be?
Zodiac. I mean, one word.
Zodiac.
That's what he'll always be remembered for.
Wow.
You know, I think he's long past feeling a need to talk about any of that stuff. And he still gets lots of calls about it. And it's just not, you know, he's got so many other things that he's done that he's focused on and, you know, and
Does it kind of bother him or is he okay with it? Like, is he like, okay, that's part of my life, you know?
I think there's a point where it's bothered him too. I mean, part of it is like I was talking before about like everybody's got a suspect, everybody's got an uncle, everybody's got a dad that it's surprising. You know, I think the first time I really witnessed that were just these unexpected people that came forward. And so I remember in high school, I was at some event with some friends from school and one of the moms was driving us home and somehow it came up that he had written that book. And she's like, oh my God, do you think he would talk to me? I had some questions or whatever. And so I asked him and I forwarded his number to her or vice versa or something. And she called him and she's like, my ex-husband was a Zodiac. It was the first thing she said. And it just like, you know, she didn't say any of that when we were in the car. She seemed so normal. Her daughter seemed so normal. You know, just like there would be nothing that would tell me that she was going to say those words. You know, I think that's the first time that I saw that. I heard to some degree about people coming in to talk to Toski and saying this and that and having all their.
But I saw a recent post on your dad's page and people were still saying, I need to talk to you. I know who the Zodiac is. I mean, they're still saying that.
Yeah.
And then other people saying, we know you're the Zodiac, like that kind of, you know, throwing it back at your dad, which.
Yeah. Turn yourself in. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, wow, it's just one of those things. But I feel like with all the. Like there's even a new series, I think on Netflix, like Armchair Sleuths, like where it's like,
I think there's a few of them. Yeah.
But it's just where all these people are trying to figure all these things out, you know, like why this happened, what this happened. So I can imagine that Zodiac, since, you know, there's so many people still trying to think they know the answers or, you know, it's been unsolved. I have even friends who are like, oh no, that was solved. That guy died in prison. I'm like, who are you talking about? I said, I think you have it confused with the Golden State Killer. That's different.
Yeah.
Like this is a different person. You know, and then, you know, there was all these ties too to those different murders happening at around the same time that it was just one person or people like, you know, three or four people that were working together, like all these different, there's so many different theories and whatever. So it's,
well, you know, it's tricky. It's a really fine line to walk because on one point, you know, he did the book and he put it out there. And the idea was that like, I've done all this research. I want to get it out there. And minus some things that are pointed out in the book that I've changed this name or I've done this or this took place in a different place or something like that, where I don't think he would have done that. I think that's the publisher saying, no, you can't say that name, you know? Mm-hmm. And so each of the suspects has a fake name and some people that just didn't want to be listed in the book with their real name are not, you know? And then
well, that kind of makes sense. Cause I think, you know, nowadays too, you know, it's just people, well, then I can imagine like not wanting to be anonymous or at least, you know, just be protected that way.
Yeah. Well, and even being on here, like I try to be a little careful about like when I say somebody's name, just because I haven't asked them permission to like, hey, I'm going to be a podcast that's talking about Zodiac. Like there's a reporter at the Chronicle who now anytime there's a Zodiac story, he's the one that like they rope in. I don't know if he does it now, but he went through some experiences. He had to change his phone number. I think he said he had moved, but I don't know if he said he had to move. But it was just the amount of attention that gets directed towards you with that is just, you know, I think I said denial of service before. That's kind of what it is. And you want to be respectful to everybody, but there's that line of, it's great, you're thinking, you're doing all these things, but then there's the, well, it can't be everybody's uncle, you know? It like, how do you wean this stuff? And it's the internet, so you're never, never quite going to have a really well-balanced debate on things
exactly.
either.
Not anymore, at least.
But then it's a powerful tool to share those things. So I think more people today know about Zodiac. The book
double-edged sword, in a way. It's like a double-edged sword, seriously. Like, it's like, okay, this is good, but
yeah. You know, yeah. And you hear those cases back where they'd say, like, oh, the police would leave out a detail in the murder because they want to be able to know, like, if somebody's talking truth or not, you know? So, and we wean these people out very quickly. But even then, you got to be careful because maybe somebody come in knowing that. You know?
They could be like, yeah, I got this. I got them fooled. Yeah, you never know. You never know. When the word serial killer came out, it wasn't a word that was commonly used. You know, it kind of came out a little later, like, let's say, like, Jack the Ripper, right? A serial killer, but wasn't really called a serial killer. He was just called a mass murderer, you know?
Yeah. Well, so, I think it's one of those things, like, I don't think we thought there were a lot of serial killers at the time, but I think it's a case of taxonomy. You know, you don't have a label for it, so you have no way to compartmentalize it or boxes or to even notice it. There's a friend of mine that had this, he'd say this thing about, it's like, you know, it's like when you buy a new car and then you look around and suddenly everybody else is driving a Lamborghini. It's like, and he's like, oh, or Honda Civic, you know. but it is, it's something happens, something becomes important to you at a moment. And I think labeling something, having a name for something is a big deal. To back up in history here, I know I told you a little bit about Radiolab. That was the name of the podcast I was trying to remember. They'd done this episode. I don't remember the name of the episode, but the general theme was about color. And they talked about, you know, color theory, color blindness, how pigments are made. But the very first story in there has always stuck with me. And it was about a guy that was, I think he was doing a dissertation or he's doing something on Homer and the Iliad. And he was just a huge fan of these. But there was something that had stood out to him as he was working on this. And Homer had referred to the sea as being wine colored. And he goes, that's odd. And he's like, where could this be? What water is wine colored? You know, he couldn't figure it out. And then he went through and he's like, well, does he say wine in the book again? Is he using that as an adjective? And then he started going through. He said, well, let me categorize all the colors. It's black, white, 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 black, black, white, whatever. Wine, black, white, black. He's like, wine is the only non-neutral that he uses. And he says black, white, and wine.
Wow.
And he's like, well, this is really strange. And he starts looking around at all these other old texts. And I don't know if this is him at this point or if this is a later study that kind of spawned out of it. But they looked and they said, well, when you look through the history of color in literature, usually the colors will appear. The first color that ever appears is usually red and whatever the name for that within that culture. And so, and I think it goes like red, yellow, green, blue, or something like that, or red, yellow, purple, green, blue, or I think purple is one of those high ones because you always get those like purple is associated with royalty, probably because it was rare in those periods. Mm-hmm. It was hard to make or hard to find.
My favorite color, by the way, so that makes sense. I'm just kidding.
Well, you are royalty.
You know.
this has always stuck with me. I thought that was really interesting. And one of the theories on these is like, until they could make that pigment, they didn't have a word for it. So it didn't exist, you know? And, you know, they say, well, blue, come on. Blue is everywhere. Look at the sky. Just look up in the air. Yeah. And the theory was that the sky wasn't a thing. You didn't think of it. You didn't have a label for it. It didn't exist, you know?
Wow.
So as we label things, they become more important and they get grounded and they solidify in the way we view the world and all these things. So I just always found that really interesting. So it didn't mean that they weren't there all along. Other people weren't driving Lamborghinis. You just didn't see it until you had this connection, you know?
Right.
And so I think with serial killers, it was the same thing. I think that, you know, first time I ever heard of it, it would have been from Dad and it would have been about the Zodiac. Mm-hmm. And probably some other cases, but I think as a term, you know, my guess, I think if you watch Mindhunters, the David Fincher Netflix thing, mm-hmm. That's a lot of what that's about. They're coming up with that. They're starting to use that term as a label. We have to study these people differently. They're out of the norm, you know?
Right.
But yeah, if you go back, Jack the Ripper and, you know, in the 1800s, there's other, like, they're definitely documented cases. We just didn't call them that.
Yeah, it was just a different, like you said, it wasn't named that way. You know, like, Now you can, like, when I think serial killer too, I kind of think more like Jeffrey Dahmer kind of ish. Like, I think of him and Ted Bundy. Like, those are the two names that pop into my head, maybe because I kind of knew about them a little more growing up, but those two are the ones that pop into my head immediately. Yeah. And then Zodiac is obviously, like, I always kind of feel like Zodiac's in its own category for some reason. I don't know why. I've always kind of felt that. Like, it's just kind of, he's kind of in a different category.
Yeah.
Because I think of all the hype and I think of being unresolved and all that. I think it's just kind of always been this strange, I don't know, like, anomaly out there, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's really interesting. Stay tuned for episode 5, our final in the series, Drawing on Serial Killers, coming soon. Thank you for listening to the Circumstance Podcast. I hope you will continue this journey with me as I explore various life circumstances to help inform, inspire, and educate. To hear more episodes, subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram. See you next time on Circumstance.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.